The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Last time we visited the topic of transhumanism in episode 65, I received post-show emails letting me know about all the things that we didn't cover in our one-hour program. Well, here at Skeptically Speaking, we are nothing if not customer service focused. So today we have part two on transhumanism with returning guests George Dvorsky of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and worldofweirdthings.com blogger Greg Fish. This time we'll be sticking to the two most asked for transhumanist subtopics, artificial intelligence and the singularity. But before we get to that, I have a few news items. A few weeks ago on episode 71, we did a speaking up with singer-songwriter Monty Harper about songs from the science frontier. Monty was raising funds to produce an album of science-themed songs for kids, and we're happy to say that he reached his goal. So congratulations, Monty, and thank you from Monty and from Skeptically Speaking to all the listeners that donated. You've done your part to ensure that we're raising the next generation to be more scientifically literate than our current one. You can find updates about production and such at montyharper.com. And it is also the one-year anniversary of grassrootsskeptics.org. They're the only place on the entire internet that you can find pretty much every local skeptical group in one place. They have some great group resources, and the founder, K.O. Myers, very friendly guy. He's happy to help you sort out all your skeptical group needs. So congratulations, grassroots skeptics. You've been doing wonderful work, and we look forward to many more years of skeptical solidarity. And now, for speaking up. We're here with Joey Haben, the author of newlynerfed.net, a blog about disability, skepticism, and assorted geeky stuff. Welcome back to the show, Joey.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So today we're talking about deaf culture. So can you define that, first of all?
I can sort of define it. Deaf culture was developed by deaf people who use sign language. And for the purposes of this interview and because of my personal experience, I'm going to be talking about American deaf culture and American Sign Language, which is mostly used in the United States and also a lot of Canada. So I don't know for certain whether the stuff I'm going to be talking about applies to Canadian deaf culture. It might, but I really mostly know about American deaf culture. It's a set of values and norms that are shared by deaf people, not all deaf people, but people who choose to be involved with the culture. And it is very closely linked to American Sign Language. The two pretty much developed together. Most likely, you would say that the most important value in deaf culture is the use of sign language.
There's big D deaf, and then there's little d deaf.
Big D deaf to denote somebody or something that is related to the culture. Little d deaf has a much broader scope. The little d deaf community involves people who do not necessarily relate to the culture, includes hearing people like interpreters. You would call me part of the deaf little d deaf community, even though I don't have a hearing impairment at all.
So deaf culture became a potential topic idea for speaking up after our last episode on transhumanism, where we really got into physical augmentation, like prosthetic limbs and like hearing aids. So now most people don't think about the fact that some people are actually opposed to hearing aids. So why would that be?
Deaf culture has historically been, I would say, not very much in favor of things like hearing aids, and especially the bigger issue really these days is cochlear implants. People refer to it as the bionic ear. It's an actual implant into the ear that helps you interpret sounds, but it doesn't actually fix deafness. It's just a different way of hearing. And yeah, these things have traditionally been rejected by the hardliners in deaf culture. And as with any culture, it is not homogenous. You know, that's one of the misconceptions about deaf culture, is that everybody thinks this, everybody thinks that. There are many deaf cultures and there's many different ideas in deaf culture. The choice behind not using assistive devices goes back to the use of sign language and the value of sign language and not wanting to have to interact with people in a hearing way. These people tend to spend their days surrounded by other deaf people, working with deaf people, using sign language, and they simply have no need for assistive devices like hearing aids, for things like emergency devices, fire alarms and that kind of thing. They have visuals, also doorbells, they have blinking lights and that kind of thing, alarm clocks, they have devices that can shake the bed. So there's a sense that even though there are these things that can help, many deaf people feel they just don't need them.
So do they see themselves as fully able then?
There is a feeling among some people in deaf culture that they will say that deafness is not a disability, which is probably one of the hardest things for hearing people to understand.
Well, someone like me, if there's a problem with my body, I want to remedy it. Like, I have poor vision, so I wear glasses. And if someone loses a leg, they get a prosthetic. So how is it different for deaf people?
One way that deaf culture was passed down was through deaf schools and deaf clubs. Another way it was passed down was through people that are known as deaf of deaf. Only about 10% of deafness is actually genetic. And there are some well-known families that have just throughout the years and throughout the generations have historically always been deaf. You know, most of the children are deaf and their children are deaf and so forth. So for these people, they're born without hearing and they are surrounded by people who function perfectly well, communicate perfectly well, work perfectly well without hearing. So for them, this isn't a loss. It's impossible for you to conceive of having that thing. Therefore, you don't see it as a loss. And especially in a situation where there are so many ways to function without having to hear, like I said, with sign language or with new technologies.
So is there a different culture around being deaf than there is around being blind? And why?
Deaf people are a historically oppressed minority. And by this I mean, although it gets lumped into an idea of sensory loss, like deafness and blindness, there is no language of blindness. I mean, there's Braille, but that's a code. It's not an actual language. Deaf people were stereotyped as retarded, mute, unable to work, unable to be taught, unable to be taught language. This hasn't, as far as I know, been as much of a problem with blind people. This kind of oppression is sort of how deaf culture built, and the values in it can be seen to go back to this oppression. So the culture developed when deaf people were together sort of back in the 19th century, segregated in deaf schools. And by the way, this idea of segregation for deaf people has not historically been that bad of a thing, because in these schools, this is where deaf culture developed and where the language developed. And there was this feeling of banding together to be able to show the world that deaf people can do these things. They can learn language. They can be taught. Because blind people are able to communicate with the world at large without much intercession, as far as just speaking and you know, hearing and being heard, there hasn't been a culture in the same way that's developed around blindness. That's my understanding.
I'm just wondering, do you see any parallels to groups that don't want to take any medical intervention, like blood transfusions? Because some people would consider deafness a medical issue.
Aside from the view that we've been talking about, that, you know, deafness is not a disability, that there's a legitimate culture and all that, hearing people tend to have a pathological view of deafness or a medicalized view of deafness, which is, as you said, something is wrong and must be fixed. Now, like I said, in deaf culture, there are the extremists, the people that, let's put it this way, as somebody in the deaf community myself, and I don't at all pretend to be speaking for all deaf people or any deaf person for that matter. This is just my experience. I was a sign language interpreter, and I was also a instructor of underprepared deaf college students. So my feeling about this is I tend to be very, whatever a deaf person wants is okay by me. It's up to the individual. There are people who are extreme to the point where they don't want any involvement with hearing culture. They don't want to know anyone with cochlear implants. They don't want to be involved with that. I don't know if it's quite the same as the medical situation, the blood transfusions. It's an interesting parallel. There are some who would say that denying a cochlear implant to a deaf child is child abuse. People do say that. The thing is about denying vaccinations or blood transfusions, that kind of thing, those are life-saving interventions. Whereas a cochlear implant is more arguably a life-saving intervention. I would argue that it isn't. I would say it is more of an assistive device. So while it may seem like a very extreme position, and I do feel it's an extreme position to completely reject the idea of cochlear implants, I personally don't find it as egregious as the people who actually will not let their children get medical care that would save their lives.
Well, then let's not look at it from even a life-threatening point of view. The fact is the world is set up around people that can hear. So if there is an assistive device available, does that just put the child at a disadvantage and that's enough?
What puts a child at a disadvantage is the viewpoint of the parents towards that child. If the viewpoint of the parents is, we have a deaf child and we want to give that child every opportunity to operate as well as they can in the world, that child is going to succeed. They might give their child a cochlear implant. They'll hopefully also learn sign language. They will give that child the most important thing they possibly can, which is the development of a natural language before the critical point. And that natural language can be English. If the child is implanted early, you know, assuming they get an implant or maybe uses hearing aids and gets a really good education in English, which is tough but possible, that's fine. It doesn't have to be sign language. With deaf children, it is more usually that they will learn sign language as their first natural language. The problem comes when parents say cochlear implants will fix our child. They will turn our child from deaf to hearing and implant their kid and then not do a whole lot of extra work with that kid on including them in daily conversations and letting them acquire English naturally. There was a video going around recently of a little baby who had been implanted and the implant had been activated and it was the first time, I guess, hearing its mother's voice or something. And it was very moving. A lot of people were very moved by this. What you have to understand is that child did not hear its mother's voice. It heard clicks and beeps. I can't say precisely, but from what I understand, it's sort of a mechanical sound. So that kid is still a deaf kid who needs to be trained to hear and understand what those sounds are. And people do this very successfully all the time at any age. But too often, deaf children of hearing families whose doctors and other parents take the purely medicalized pathological viewpoint that you need to fix your child. In that case, just slapping a cochlear implant onto that kid is not going to help. There are many stories of deaf people who were implanted as kids and as adults took them out, turned them off because it didn't help them. It didn't turn them into a successful hearing person all of a sudden. There's more work than that that needs to be done. So it's not quite as black and white as people who just think, oh, broken ear cochlear implant can fix. There's a lot more involved in that.
Well, this is a community that most people have no idea even exists. It's a mighty touchy topic, so thank you for coming on the show to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today's episode is part two of our unexpected series on transhumanism, and our guests from part one have returned. We have Greg Fish. Greg is a computer science grad student and science blogger. whose work has appeared in everything from Business Week and Discovery News to Seed and IO9. He writes about unusual cutting-edge science while researching AI models and their applications. And George Dvorsky, a Canadian futurist and ethicist. He's written extensively about the impacts of the aforementioned cutting-edge science and technology. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome back, guys. So this episode will be focusing on artificial intelligence and the singularity. Now, we seem to have brilliant timing on this, really, because last week was the Singularity Summit. George, can you tell us about that?
Sure. The Singularity Summit, it's the annual confab that brings together the world's leading authorities on this particular subject, namely the singularity and the development of pretty powerful artificial intelligence. And this year's conference, as per usual, although last year's was, I believe, in New York, this year's was in San Francisco, and it takes place over the course of one weekend. And the theme, they had a couple of themes this year. On the first day, they talked about the future of human evolution. And then on the second day, they shifted it more toward, I guess, a pragmatic, practical theme, and that is the how and why of how we should solve the world's problems. And as usual, the Singularity Summit is characterized by the quality of the speakers, and this year's was no exception. Some of the highlights included Gregory Stock, who's the author of Redesigning Humans, and he spoke about, for example, values, whether or not we'll be able to preserve values as we become less and less biological, whether or not we can actually embed our artificial intelligence with human values. And then Ray Kurzweil, who's definitely probably the most well-known of those who talk about the singularity, he spoke. And then other individuals that spoke, there was Ben Goertzel, who was definitely a key player in all this. He himself is actually kind of working on trying to develop more sophisticated AI. And then Steve Mann from Toronto was there. He, as many Canadians, might recognize that name. He's probably the world's famous cyborg in that he has kind of modified his body, not necessarily biologically or intrinsically, but certainly through the wearables that he adapts and his iTap devices. He fancies himself as a cyborg, and that's his basic way of kind of getting into the community. Another speaker there was Eliezer Yudkowsky, again another computer theorist, and Ramez Nam, author of More Than Human. So that was the Singularity Summit, and again, as always, there's great food for thought that emerges from these particular events.
So, as you said, one of the things that the summit addressed, because that's a variety of things, artificial intelligence in its multiple incarnations. Greg, the concept of artificial intelligence isn't really as clear as movies or TV would make it out to be. So tell us about that.
Well, artificial intelligence is a pretty complex topic. There's a lot of, it's sort of at that intersection of science and philosophy, where you try to figure out what actually constitutes intelligence and then try to automate those features, bring it to something that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see those abilities from. The goal of AI initially was to develop a machine that can think. That's actually in quite broad terms. So over time, computer scientists have broken it down to systems that are, for example, rule-based systems, where you have certain conditions and a system goes through a particular scenario and comes up with what you would say are good outcomes or desirable outcome based on the rules that you give it. There are evolutionary systems which go through different scenarios and you basically put them through a fitness model where they perform a certain number of tasks. If they perform them successfully, then the programming, the code, and the ideas, if we can call them that, with which they came up, are used for future iterations and are later refined. And, of course, ultimately, some people hope that you can create a machine that would actually think like a human or very similarly to a human and could actually interact and understand emotions, understand sarcasm and jokes, and really sort of almost be your friend.
So what we really have right now is rules-based AI.
Yes, primarily. What we're actually doing is we're currently focusing on just making programs and making devices that can perform relatively complex tasks and basically make life easier for us. We're using them to extend our own abilities, and at the same time, we're using things that computers are really good at, but people can do conceptually, but not necessarily all that well by themselves, and really turn it into a workable model. So, for example, Humans are pretty good at math, but we can't really do it very consistently. If we forget a number here and there, we might not remember an equation. Computers are awesome at math. They're much better at math than humans can possibly be. But that's sort of been the human way of coping with drawbacks that we've been dealt by evolution. Whenever we're just not quite strong enough, not quite, you know, clever enough to do something that we really want to do, we invent a tool that helps us do it. And AI is basically kind of a continuation of that.
So we understand well enough how to build programs that make intelligent decisions, as long as those responses are basically all built into a list somewhere?
In a way, yes. We're also trying to get programs to deduce. So, for example, we give them some basic rules. This happens with these conditions, and this happens with those conditions, and the overlap is here. And then sort of try and have them experiment and figure out. We can also simulate systems that learn using something called artificial neural networks. And what they do is they sort of try and mimic the way that our neurons connect when we learn something. When we learn something, our neurons create new bonds between themselves. And the stronger the bond, the better we know something. And conversely, the more we practice, the stronger the bond. So we're essentially trying to replicate the same thing in intelligent agents. So the idea is the more an intelligent agent chooses certain things, or the more it's been trained to respond to a certain stimuli, to a certain entry, the more likely it is to use it. So sort of building a probabilistic model, sort of how we actually function on a daily basis.
So George, how long do you think until we have a rules-based AI that's smart enough to handle most of the questions we're likely to throw at it?
That sounds to me like, I guess, a rules-based AI that's pretty close to being human equivalent, something that would we would probably consider as having passed the Turing test. And the question is how long before something like that, and that's a very good question. You have number of people speculating anywhere from 20 years through to still another 100 years. And there's still so much we don't know necessarily about cognition and what Greg was talking about. I mean, those are all very hard problems still in terms of how exactly do we go about probabilistic reasoning. How does conscious awareness, for example, even factor into all that? So it's still, I think, a bit ways off from being able to pinpoint an exact time when we can develop that kind of a rules-based AI.
Maybe it's a different question then. How long before we have, again, a rules-based AI that's smart enough to send out into the world as an independent agent, maybe in the form of a robot?
In a way, we're actually already there. I mean, we have highly specialized AIs and highly specialized little robots that are being developed around the world in various labs that can do a very specific thing, and they can do that very specific thing very well. The trouble is when you're trying to up the level of sophistication in terms of the tasks that you're putting these bots into or these AIs into. So let's say you put it in an environment that it doesn't really understand or recognize, and you give it a totally new concept in terms of the problem it's trying to solve. It'll be completely kerfuddled. It won't know what to do at all. That's the challenge, is creating not artificial intelligence, but what you're describing, which is artificial general intelligence, which is, I think, the shift now conceptually in terms of the computer theory behind all this. Is we have to stop thinking about creating highly specialized AIs and instead think, how do we create a thinking machine that you can put into any kind of a situation, in any kind of a scenario, essentially what humans do, and be able to kind of figure it out and basically solve its way out through any kind of a problem you give it. And the good example that I like to give is how excited we got, of course, with Deep Blue when it defeated Garry Kasparov in chess. You know, absolutely, this is an expert system. In a way, it's drawing on some very sophisticated AI and the laws that we're describing now. It does one thing exceptionally well. It's an expert system. But you put that same machine out in the rain, and it will have absolutely no clue that it needs to get out of the rain or it's going to be destroyed. That's the difference between AI and an AGI, which is really the real goal. Those are the goalposts, and that's the kind of thing that is still decades and decades off.
And would you agree with that, Greg?
I would agree to a certain extent, but with a few caveats. One issue with creating sort of a general machine is think about the scope of all the things that you do on a daily basis. Evolution sort of prepared us for it over millions of years. So when we're trying to start with a general agent, we are millions of years behind. You know, it's not so much a game of catch-up as it is a game of just trying to figure out how to do it completely differently. And at some point, having a general intelligence isn't actually very useful outside of, say, purely academic speculation, because what we really need is we need to have machines that will be able to do the complex tasks that we want to do, do dangerous work that we'd rather not do, like, for example, fix nuclear reactors, or, you know, be able to create statistics from huge, enormous, tedious calculations that we honestly don't have time to do. But from there on in, trying to develop a general system, we would actually have a lot of problems finding use for it. And just the program in its entire scope, just the coding alone would take decades, much less actual testing and refining. And even if you're going through the artificial neural networks, you still need to pick different individual tasks and go through them one by one. Now, if we design a system that functions more like a brain, or say we were to link up different elements of actual organic tissue with machinery and try and create some sort of a hybrid of sorts, then maybe we could be looking at something that could approach to the general intelligence model. But other than that, I would actually see I would see it as a very difficult proposal to say, well, let's just build a general machine or a general AI system.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guests today are Greg Fish from worldofweirdthings.com and George Dvorsky of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. We're talking about artificial intelligence and the singularity, and the gentlemen are waiting to take your questions. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So you mentioned human-modeled AI, Greg. What would you say the major obstacles to developing that would be?
Well, probably one of them would be that we're not quite sure exactly how the human brain works. We're having a very tough time trying to figure it out simply because there's so much to it. There are billions and billions and billions of neurons, and they go through a very sophisticated growth and development system, and they change over time. In fact, that's the number one reason why we're as intelligent as we are. We have a lot of plasticity in our neurons and their connections. So trying to track that down and figure it out is very difficult in the first place. The second problem is more, I would say, a philosophical problem. We're still trying to really nail down what is it that makes someone intelligent. Because when we talk about intelligence, we talk about different kinds of intelligence. For example, we can say somebody's, you know, really book smart, and it used to be that someone who knew a lot of things was considered a genius, but then we realized, wait a minute, if you just know a lot of things, it doesn't really mean anything. How do you apply it? How can you see the world? And we sort of changed our worldview about it, and now intelligence means we're really good at spotting patterns and constructing things and using strategy. But again, at the same time, we develop a lot of AI tests, and people take a lot of AI tests and get really high scores, but at the same time, you can have someone who's a Mensa member, but you'd say, I wouldn't trust this guy to get me coffee, much less try and, you know, solve global warming, because they're just not really, say, necessarily curious.
Right.
So, you know, what part does curiosity play? What part does conscience play? We're still trying to really figure it out.
George?
Yeah, you're asking again, what are the obstacles to developing a human-modeled AI? And
mm-hmm.
There's still a bunch, but I just to kind of speak to what Greg was saying, I think he's painting a more complex picture than actually needs to be portrayed in terms of this particular problem. Now, we do have a functional model, namely the human brain, which we can work off of. And what we're trying to do here is what's referred to as whole brain emulation, basically not trying to simulate various functions of the brain, but actually creating a one-to-one model where we've taken the physical brain and recreated it, whether it be in computer substrate or even some kind of biological substrate. It's still the idea is still to get the same functions down pat. And basically, what is spawning this kind of this approach is the so-called Church Turing thesis. And this is the idea that any machine can emulate any other Turing machine, which is a fancy way of saying, look, the human brain, it's made out of the same stuff that's made out of anything in this world. It's just matter, and it's uses energy like anything else does. It's stuff that exists here. There's nothing mystical or fantastic about it, and it's probably computationally based. And this is kind of the great paradigm shift that's happened since the advent of the computer, is that we may actually be able to replicate the human brain through the computational model. In terms of actually how we get there, we're still a far ways off, I would say. But what we need to do first is improve the hardware component, which is namely the computer science aspect. We need to get machines that are simply much more powerful than they are now, because the human brain is quite obviously the most powerful computational device that we're actually in possession of. We also need to actually get down into the nitty-gritty and look deep inside the human brain in terms of how it's working. So we need better microscopy and scanning technologies, which will include things like brain slicing techniques, where we will visibly study the cognitive action down at the molecular scale. Things like molecular studies of individual neurons, scanning the neural connection patterns, and studying the function of the neural clusters and so on. And related to this, we also need some better advances in the neurosciences so that we can get a better understanding of how cognition works, how it's been modularized in the brain, and even get down to the issues of consciousness and finding the neural correlates of consciousness as well. I'm also a bit of an advocate of, and I know Greg is not, but an advocate of looking at our DNA as well for some clues in terms of how we can construct a human brain. I mean, let's face it, the DNA basically provides a bit of a blueprint in terms of how to construct the human brain from scratch. I agree that the DNA doesn't tell us how to create a fully functional human brain, but it certainly will tell us how we actually go from nothing to creating kind of this clump of cells that eventually will start to develop all the neural capacities that human brains typically have. And those are pretty much the hurdles right there. I mean, it's an easier said than done type thing. We basically require three main capabilities. We need to be able to physically scan the brains in order to acquire the necessary information, the ability to interpret that scanned data so that we can build a software model, and then the ability to simulate this model at a very accurate scale.
Greg, did you want to add anything?
Actually, yes. When it comes to the steps that George just laid out, actually a lot of them are being done right now. We're definitely looking at the brain very closely. We're scanning it. And all of the advances that George has mentioned are currently works in progress. And right now, we can actually take a brain and scan it. We can be quite accurate about it, and of course, in this kind of scenario, you can't get too accurate. But we can scan it, we can get it into a computer, but it's that third part we're having so much trouble with, because it's that correct, accurate computation that goes on in the brain that we're trying to nail down. That's where all the difficulties lie. So what I'm interested in terms of simulating human cognitive functions is seeing how that wiring comes together during development, and from there on in trying to see how the actual computation takes place, because we know that there's a kind of a repeating structure of different neural circuits in the brain, and it's that repetition that builds up into areas that can do very, very complex things. But how does it actually work? What do I tell the computer to run? How do I tell it to run it? And how do I actually deal with its results? How do I put out the different outputs? Or rather, how would I actually deal with the outputs that it would generate? That's the question.
So even if we could achieve human-modeled AI, that's still not considered true AI.
That's a very difficult question, because true AI is different from person to person. Some people would consider true AI anything that can pass the Turing test, which is essentially if you have a human talking to other humans or different computers, intelligent computers via IM, and not be able to tell who's the human, who's the computer, then you've achieved some sort of intelligence. How it's done to some people is irrelevant. If they can pass that test, then it's true AI. And for others, they really put, there are people like John Searle, for example, who put a lot of stock in vitalism, in this idea that there's something really special about the human brain, and there's absolutely nothing that will ever emulate it. So for them, there will never be such a thing as a true AI.
I would say that it absolutely is an AI. If we have, as a frame of reference, an emulated brain that's, let's say, in computer substrate, it's strictly now at this point software based and running pretty sophisticated algorithms, but absolutely that one-to-one emulation that I was talking about, then, I mean, how could you say it's not artificial in that sense? It's a completely synthetic construct that was devised by human intelligence. So I think that by that kind of a definition, it almost certainly has to be considered an artificial intelligence. Simply, I think really what the distinguishing factor for me is not just how it came into being, but the substrate, the stuff that it's actually made out of and where it actually does its computation.
And we have a question from the website.
Might it not be easier to create an organic AI? With short life cycles and selection, couldn't we make it evolve intelligence rather than trying to create intelligence from the bottom up? And that's from Jeff Blocken.
That's definitely an approach, and I think Greg did touch upon that. Those are evolutionary algorithms, adaptive algorithms, where absolutely you don't necessarily have to kind of create everything from scratch. You can basically set up an array of algorithms that are have, I suppose, a task or a goal that you want those algorithms to complete. And you don't actually have to complete the algorithms yourself. You just have to kind of let it, just turn the crank and let it go. And from an evolutionary perspective or from a Darwinian perspective, it will parse its way through to finally get to that ultimate goal. And just through a selectional process. So that's definitely definitely one avenue that I think will absolutely gain more and more currency and in more favor as years go by. And I'm sure Greg's going to agree with me on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very well-established idea in computer science right now, and I know that there's quite a bit of work being done on actually trying to create fitness models for different machines and try and see if you can nudge them to be more intelligent. And in fact, there's some experiments that have been done in Switzerland that are really showing that there's quite a bit of potential to that theory. And I've taken a look at the studies, and they're actually very, very compelling.
True AI wouldn't necessarily even look like human intelligence, would it?
It depends. If it's a brain emulation, then it would most necessarily act and respond like a human would. Mind you, you're talking about an entity that is in a different environment, so it is just simply based out of that going to have been enculturated, and will have the different kinds of social skills than you would have, like, let's say, a normal biological human. I think that goes without saying. But I think qualitatively, they will largely be the same thing. But if, let's say, the approach to, I guess we're getting a bit fixated on the whole brain emulation model here. Obviously, the first part of the discussion here was, could we actually get there through strict hard coding? And creating, I guess, the laws and the rules to set up an intelligence. And in that sense, you would absolutely create something qualitatively different than human intelligence. I mean, in the space of all possible intelligent modalities, which is an absolutely massive space, the human, what we consider to be human-specific intelligence, is a very small blip in a large scheme of all possible ways of thinking. I mean, look at how all the different animals in the animal kingdom and the different mammals, dolphin intelligence and elephant intelligence, while there's certainly going to be some consistency, there's definitely going to be as well some variation in terms of how they interpret the world and what kind of subjective awareness they have, and of course the kind of cognitive capacities they have as well. So an artificial intelligence that wasn't based on any kind of human model, for example, would be quite different than human intelligence, absolutely.
And we have a question from the chat room.
Does exploring AI and modeling it upon human brain function have implications for how we perceive ourselves and our intelligence? And that's from Mary Melody XX.
Absolutely, absolutely. Part of the reason why there are philosophers who say that there's no way that we could ever make true AI because there's just something really special about humans is that idea that we're unique. And through thousands of years of religious beliefs that we were specially created, and through a fair bit of self-aggrandizement, really, we sort of tend to think of ourselves as specially chosen or specially selected just because we are where we necessarily are. So when you're actually trying to model AI and you really start getting somewhere or start seeing some really impressive results that start approaching something even remotely like human intelligence, what that really tells you is that humans might not necessarily be as complex as we think we are. We might be really sort of overestimating our abilities. And there might be much less to us than we'd really like to think. So in certain respects, I think the study of AI is sort of a window to our emotions as well about it.
There's some pretty scary areas here. Not that I want to dwell on the scary areas, but obviously there's going to be benefit. You know, anytime we expand our knowledge, it's a good thing, I think. And I would never want to kind of put up a veil of ignorance on these sorts of things. But like any kind of an advancement, there are going to be some dangers. One might be more of a philosophical one that I'm not sure what kind of the implications may be, but we may actually prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that we don't, in fact, have free will. And that actually seems to be where we're headed. A lot of neuroscientists and philosopher of minds are now thinking that, in fact, that is the case. And there's some evidence, whether it be through evidence that we see through functional magnetic image resonance imaging or through other bit of data. It's scary to say this, but it does appear that we don't have free will. So if we could actually prove that, I'm wondering what kind of implications that will be. And somewhat related to that, the more we know and more we understand about how the human brain works in terms of things like decision making and how we change our mind and how we even store memories, is we open ourselves up potentially. And I don't want to sound all paranoid and conspiratorial here, but it does open up a different channel for how we could be manipulated and how our brains might be perhaps a bit. Let's just say that they might be a bit more exploitable in terms of how we can change people's minds and opinions and that sort of a thing. So that's perhaps a dangerous area that we're heading in, should we gain a much more expansive understanding of how the human brain works.
And we'll be right back with more artificial intelligence and the singularity after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to Carl Mamer, host of The Conspiracy Skeptic, a podcast that examines the breathless claims and actual evidence behind today's most tenacious conspiracy theories. And on Speaking Up, skeptic Josh Witten joins us to explain what irrational beliefs can teach us about evolutionary theory. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, and that's skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the air with Greg Fish from worldofweirdthings.com and George Dvorsky of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And we've been discussing artificial intelligence. So would it be fair to say that the singularity is the logical progression of these kinds of artificial intelligence?
I guess in a way you could say yes. Why I say that is if we can actually construct a human brain from scratch or even create a kind of artificial intelligence that has the capacity of the human brain, and again, it is based in non-biological substrate, if we can get to there, we can probably get to beyond that as well. If we can create a human equivalent brain, then we can certainly start to think about enhancing a brain or enhancing an AI. But moreover, you can actually start to create an AI that's capable at that point, if it's human equivalent, at that point you can equip it with the tools and the know-how with which it can start to improve upon itself and self-modify, what's known as recursive self-improvement. And that is, at that point, something that will, I think, inevitably lead to what we're describing as a singularity.
Greg?
When it comes to actually creating machines that are supposedly beyond human intelligence, I've really seen very few concrete ideas about how that would actually be done, because there's a slight problem with us considering our intelligence to be a benchmark. We're sort of not quite sure what goes beyond it because we're not necessarily that smart, you know, hence the benchmark. But the ideas that I've seen sort of focus around allowing this AI to basically browse huge knowledge bases and create different cross-references and come up with new ideas and hypotheses and guide different research and actions. And in part, that's happening now because there's so many scientific papers out there that some scientists have actually started to create programs to read those papers for them and try and come up with takeaways. And that's actually where it starts hitting a couple snags, because in science, we tend to expect that the vast majority of the theories and the ideas and the papers out there are going to be discarded in the future. That's sort of the price of it. There's very few ideas that are really going to be profound and they're really going to stick around and they're really going to do something new. Theories like evolution, like general relativity, like gravity. This is something that has stayed with us for a very long time. But when it comes to different things like the static universe and momentia, which was the sort of precursor to inertia as described by Newton, they've all sort of been cast away. So that intelligence is going to be looking at data that's going to be pretty much obsolete as soon as next year, and how many gains will it be able to make from that point on? The other issue is when we start talking about selective recursion, we're probably going to be talking about having this machine run its own evolutionary algorithms, because it's going to have to develop machines that will be able to somehow do a certain task or develop certain skills or abilities. And then we get into the evolutionary realm. We're getting into fitness models. We get into selection. But we actually already do that. In fact, there's a lot of designs now of circuitry, of different plasma rockets, and actually even different machines, because we construct these very elaborate evolutionary models and algorithms by which we try to sort of derive what's the optimal shape for this, what's the best shape for that, and then how can we improve on this in a different environment. So again, the issue is we're talking about a beyond, but we don't really know what that beyond is. That's actually what we're supposed to find out during the singularity. But again, just getting there is going to be a major challenge, because it's such a vaguely worded concept, really.
And actually, can you make it succinct? What is the working definition of the singularity in one sentence, please?
I can give it to you in two words.
Ooh.
Intelligence explosion. And that's the definition given by I.J. Goode, and I still think that's a valid and probably the most accurate way of describing what it is. I mean, a lot of people now, whether they be in futurist communities or whomever in the computer science technology communities, they've kind of hijacked the term and basically made it whatever it is that they think it is. I mean, most people now take the term singularity and basically say it's technological change, it's the law of accelerating returns, it's convergent technologies, it's your Skype and your iPad mixed together. That is not at all what we're talking about here. I think the danger here, and I'm sensing even a little bit in some of what Greg is suggesting, is underestimating what we actually mean by the potential for the so-called intelligence explosion. What we're talking about is the development and the rapid development of ultra-intelligence machines that are highly, highly specialized expert systems that are beyond really anything that we can conceive of right now in terms of their capacity. But what makes this particularly important, what could make these machines particularly pernicious, is that they would have the requisite ability to execute on any task in which it's given. So basically, it has a goal in mind, whether that be a goal that we've given it, whether that be a goal that it has deduced for itself as being something important, or whether it be a goal that has been completely misunderstood through, let's say, some kind of poor programming or some kind of communication breakdown between ourselves and this ultra-intelligent machine. And I just want to make another distinction here. We're not talking about a conscious entity that we can necessarily have a conversation with that has a subjective awareness of its environment around itself. That's something different entirely. What we're talking about here is that expert system. Again, I keep drawing the analogy back to the Deep Blue type system, but imagine Deep Blue on steroids. But even saying that would belittle it. We're talking about machines that will operate at an order of magnitude more powerful than anything that exists today. We're talking millions of times more powerful. So I think there's a danger here in underestimating, in fact, what's actually possible from these sorts of machines. So that's what's meant by singularity. Anything else is kind of a derivation on that, and perhaps even takes us a bit off focus for what we're talking about here. It basically is, what are the ramifications of creating either a machine or a series of machines that have this kind of capacity?
We have a question from the chat room.
Is there any fiction, books, movies, comics, etc., that looks close to what the singularity might look like?
I can make some suggestions. I mean, one of my favorites is Greg Egan's Diaspora. Although that's kind of a post-singularity scenario, and Diaspora basically takes place in a world in which the human species has speciated itself into various forms. There are those that live in supercomputers, so there are true post-humans, advanced post-humans, and they live as in virtual reality existences in massive supercomputers called polises. But not everybody has opted for that kind of a future. On the surface, there are genetically modified humans that do their thing, and living on the moon are cyborgs and things like that. It's what's considered hard science fiction. So you're going to have to kind of pay attention. It's not the fluffy kind of pulp fiction that's typically a characteristic of science fiction. I recommend that one, but that's not singularity specific per se. I think one that comes to mind might be escaping me now. Greg, jump in anytime if you have some suggestions. But there's one. Specifically, I wish I could remember it now.
Actually, there's a comic. There's a series of comics by Alex Diaz that actually talks quite a bit about the singularity and the different themes involved thereof. I actually featured a couple of comics of his. They're actually very, very good. It's called Dresden Codec. So there's quite a few storylines that really try to sort of play on the transhumanist and singularity ideas, and I'm actually sort of partial to them because one of the main characters is a computer scientist, so you know, feel free to call my bias.
And we have another question from the website.
Do you find that with all the media attention that Kurzweil gets, primarily on his more fantastical predictions, that the public gets a skewed view of what the singularity really is? Do you feel that his reputation is overall good or bad for transhumanists?
I think that there is too much emphasis placed on Ray Kurzweil and the work that he's doing, and I don't want to dismiss the man and his work. I mean, I'm a fan, and I definitely have learned a lot from Ray, and I think he's definitely a major player in terms of the futurist community and helping us get a handle on where we are headed and what a potential trajectory might be. But he's not the only player out there, and I'm afraid that a lot of other great thinkers are ignored. And I can, just off the top of my head, I mean, Marvin Minsky has been talking about this for 40 years. David Chalmers has got some wonderful ideas, not necessarily specifically about singularity, but certainly about how we can create minds that are non-biological. Hans Moravec from MIT, a very famous roboticist, he's not so active anymore, but he's got a number of books from the 80s and 90s that I highly recommend. And then there's the European transhumanists like Nick Bostrom and Anders Sandberg, who are definitely on the cutting edge of these sorts of ideas. And I think that the danger is merely focusing on Ray's work and not looking at the larger community, because what the danger is as well is let's say Ray has something wrong or he's off about something, is now people are inclined to dismiss it entirely. Oh, there's not going to be a singularity, or there's not going to be this kind of development in this field, and things are moving too slowly or too quickly based on Ray's projections and so on. When you have to realize it's part of a broader discussion, and it is part of an emergent sort of a field in terms of trying to figure out where we're headed in the next 50 to 100 years or so.
Greg?
Well, Ray is very good at gathering publicity, and absolutely agree with George that there are definitely other players in the field who are worth consideration. You know, certainly second many of his selections. I would also want to add Dr. Shane Legg, who's got some very, very interesting, I think, theories about how to define intelligence, how to measure intelligence, some interesting things that could be used in fitness models. So there are definitely very interesting discussions that happen in computer science, but personally I feel that giving it a term, singularity, and trying to predict when it will happen and really sort of talk about it as an oncoming event rather than as basically ongoing progress in fields that that really merit quite a bit of attention detracts, I think, from the merit of some of the work. And certainly when Ray Kurzweil says something that just doesn't seem to make sense, and he is basically been given this face of the singularity movement, it tends to create a sort of a blowback effect, especially from skeptics, say, like myself, because it sort of pains me, because here's some very interesting things that are going on, and he's mentioning them, but at the same time, he's just getting all these details that we really need him to get right. He's getting them wrong, and I know it doesn't necessarily endear me to the Singularity Institute, and you know, I've had some very interesting discussion with people at the Singularity Institute, and they've been, you know, nothing but polite and courteous and friendly, and I certainly appreciate having the opportunity to talk to them the way that I have talked to them, but again, at the same time, I really feel that the brand Singularity is a little bit too much. There's a lot of exciting stuff that's going on in technology, and I really think we need to sort of just take it for what it is and just look at the different trends and just encourage things that look very promising and look like they have a very practical application and can really pay off for us down the road.
We have a last question from the chat room. What is the best way to invest into the eventual singularity. I want to become transhuman ASAP, and I would like to speed up the coming of the singularity. And that's from Zillion.
Helpful hints, guys.
If you want to be a transhumanist, I would really start reading up on research that's going on in computer science, in neurology, in cyborg technology, and in very specific problems that have to do with AI, things like machine vision, which is a hot area of interest, neurological modeling, things of that nature, and really pick out the areas that interest you the most and will give you the best bang for your buck, or if you will, the best return on your effort, and try and really pursue that. Eventually something's got to click.
George?
I can answer that a couple of different ways, maybe some non-conventional ways. One is to subscribe to, I guess, a belief system or a value system that's referred to as singularitarianism. And I know that's a mouthful. But singularitarianism is the general feeling that we need to advance ourselves. We need to get to the singularity as soon as possible. And the reason for that is we probably risk self-destruction before then if we don't, namely through the development of other technologies, namely nanotechnologies and nanoweapons, whether it be robotic technologies or even biological technologies such as genetic pathogens and other kinds of basically devastating pathogens that could cripple the entire human species. And the idea here is that we can circumvent or rather preempt that from happening should we get to the singularity first. Whether or not we would survive a singularity is an open question, but then at least at this point the responsibility, I suppose, is somewhat out of our hands. There's a famous quote, I think it might be from Hans Moravec, who says that a self-improving artificial intelligence that's human equivalent will be the last invention we ever need to make, because at that point it's going to take over and it will be be able to figure the rest out for us. But I think more pragmatically or more practically, I'll also answer the question by saying that there are things you can already do today. There are cognitive enhancers, there are lifestyle things that you can do that can quote-unquote make you transhuman, which is basically trying to extend on your biological capacities. And I would look into that and basically ride the wave as these things gain in sophistication.
And we are out of time. George, Greg, thanks very much for being here again. I'm not sure if this will be the last in the Transhumanist series. I'm sure the listeners will tell us. You can visit Greg's site at worldofweirdthings.com, and George is at sentientdevelopments.com. And we are at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to show your support on Facebook, on Twitter, or on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
This is K.O. Myers, founder of Grassroots Skeptics. One of the reasons why I think we need to educate the public about critical thinking is to combat the stereotype of skeptics as cynics. We're portrayed by our cultural critics as insufferable know-it-alls and heartless, close-minded debunkers. We already think we've got everything figured out, they say, and we'll dismiss out of hand anything that contradicts our materialist worldview. We've decided that there isn't any room for wonder or magic in the world, and no amount of evidence will change our minds. The thing is, that's exactly the opposite of the way genuine skepticism works. Skepticism done right is modeled on the scientific method. A true skeptic doesn't walk into any situation believing that she knows exactly what's going on. If the circumstances are familiar, she'll form a hypothesis based on her past experience, but then she'll look at the evidence before her. She'll look at all the evidence, whether it supports or challenges her hypothetical explanation. Being a skeptic is all about being open-minded. It's about inquiry, about gathering evidence, and about reserving judgment until you've got all the facts. And it's definitely about a willingness to admit that you're wrong, even about the most foregone conclusion, if the evidence that you discover contradicts your assumptions. Real, honest skepticism is humble in the face of an incredibly vast and complex universe. Skeptics find wonder and even joy in all the things that we can learn about the way that universe works. But we also delight in all the things we haven't figured out yet, because it means that there will always be more cool stuff to learn. That doesn't sound cynical to me. And I'd like to help other people understand how rewarding critical thinking can really be. Bring it on, kid.
The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.